A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been thinking about irritability, and he noticed something interesting. We talked recently about how irritability can mask depression. But he points out that irritability is also a prominent symptom in ADHD, and even more classically in autism. His real question is a two-parter. First, how is irritability actually treated across these different conditions? And second, what's the mechanism that drives that particular feeling? The one where people say their nerves are at them. What does that sensation actually map to in terms of a real biological process?
This is such a good question, because irritability is one of those symptoms that shows up everywhere in psychiatry and neurology, but it's almost never the thing people build their research careers around. It's like the utility infielder of psychopathology.
The glockenspiel of mental health symptoms. Everyone knows it's in the orchestra. Nobody wrote a concerto for it.
The colloquialism, my nerves are at me. That's actually more neurologically precise than most people realize. Let me start with the mechanism piece, because it makes the treatment question make more sense. The dominant framework is that irritability is a lowered threshold for perceiving something as threatening or frustrating, combined with a failure of top-down regulation. It's not the same as frank anger. Anger is typically directed. There's a target, there's a narrative. Irritability is more like the gain on your threat detection system is turned up so high that everything registers as an intrusion.
It's a sensory gain problem, not an emotion problem per se.
That's exactly the distinction the neuroimaging work supports. There's a research group at the NIMH, led by Ellen Leibenluft, that's been studying this for about 20 years. They've identified what they call the frustrative non-reward framework. When you expect a reward and don't get it, or when something blocks your goal, your brain registers a prediction error. In a normally calibrated system, that error signal is transient and gets regulated by prefrontal circuits. In someone with clinically significant irritability, the error signal is amplified and the regulation is weaker.
The nerves at me thing, that's literally describing heightened neural responsiveness to prediction errors.
It maps really well. The anterior insula and the dorsal anterior cingulate cortex are key nodes here. The insula is involved in interoception, your sense of your own internal bodily state. The dorsal anterior cingulate is part of what some researchers call the salience network. When something in your environment is unexpected or aversive, the salience network flags it. In people with high trait irritability, that flagging response is exaggerated, and it takes less provocation to trigger it. So that feeling of my nerves are at me is actually your insula and anterior cingulate firing in response to stimuli that a non-irritable brain would filter out as noise.
Which makes it sound less like a character flaw and more like living with a car alarm that goes off when a leaf lands on the windshield.
It also explains why irritability feels physically uncomfortable. People describe feeling jangly, on edge, like their skin is too tight. That's the interoceptive piece. The brain is generating a bodily sensation of threat even when there's no actual danger.
Let me push on the distinction between this and frank anger. If the mechanism is a hypersensitive salience network plus weak prefrontal regulation, what determines whether someone tips into irritability versus full-blown directed anger?
The key variable seems to be whether the brain constructs a specific attribution. Anger typically involves an appraisal. You've identified who or what is responsible, and you've generated a narrative about it. Irritability is the state of being primed for that appraisal without necessarily completing it. Your salience network is screaming something is wrong, but your prefrontal cortex hasn't yet constructed a coherent story about what it is. So you're left in this diffuse, agitated state where everything feels like a provocation.
It's anger without a press release.
That's the four-word version, yes.
I do my best work in four words. Okay, so let's get to the clinical piece. How does this actually present differently in depression versus ADHD versus autism? Daniel mentioned that irritability is more classical in autism, is that right?
It is, and the epidemiology bears it out. In autism, irritability is so common that it's been a primary outcome measure in major clinical trials. The Aberrant Behavior Checklist has an irritability subscale that's been used as the endpoint for the two FDA-approved medications for irritability in autism, risperidone and aripiprazole. Prevalence estimates vary, but studies consistently find that somewhere between 50 and 80% of autistic individuals experience clinically significant irritability. In ADHD, it's also very common, but studied differently. The focus has been more on emotional dysregulation as a broader construct, with irritability as one facet. In depression, irritability is actually in the DSM criteria. It's one of the ways the mood disturbance can manifest, especially in children and adolescents. There's a whole subtype called irritable depression, and this is where it gets clinically tricky, because the presentation can look very similar across conditions, but the underlying drivers are different enough that the treatment approaches diverge.
That's exactly what I want to unpack. If someone walks into a clinic and says, "I'm irritable all the time," how does a clinician figure out which flavor of irritability they're dealing with?
The first branch point is usually whether the irritability is episodic or chronic. In depression, irritability tends to be episodic. It emerges during mood episodes and recedes when the episode lifts. In ADHD, it's typically more trait-like and chronic, present from childhood. In autism, it's often chronic, but can be exacerbated by specific triggers, sensory overload, disruptions to routine, social demands.
The time course gives you the first clue.
The second branch point is what else is going on. In depression, you'll typically see the other cardinal symptoms, anhedonia, sleep disturbance, appetite changes, cognitive fog. The irritability in depression is often described by patients as feeling like everything is too much effort, and small demands feel like impositions. It's the irritability of depleted resources.
Whereas in ADHD?
In ADHD, the irritability tends to be more reactive and immediate. It's often tied to frustration tolerance. Russell Barkley has written extensively about this. He frames emotional dysregulation as a core feature of ADHD, not just a comorbidity. The mechanism is thought to involve deficits in executive function, particularly inhibitory control. When a person with ADHD encounters a frustrating stimulus, the impulse to react emotionally fires before the brakes can engage. It's not that the salience network is necessarily more sensitive, it's that the prefrontal regulation is slower to deploy.
Same endpoint, different road to get there.
In autism, the road is different again. The dominant model involves sensory processing differences and what researchers call intolerance of uncertainty. Autistic brains tend to process sensory information with higher gain. Sounds are louder, lights are brighter, textures are more intrusive. When you're constantly processing a higher sensory load, your baseline arousal is already elevated. Adding any additional demand or frustration pushes you past threshold much more quickly.
The autistic irritability is partly a bandwidth problem. The sensory processing is already consuming so much cognitive resource that there's nothing left in the tank for emotional regulation.
It connects to the nerves at me description in a really specific way. In autism, there's evidence of atypical functional connectivity in the salience network. A 2014 study by Uden and colleagues found that the salience network in autistic individuals shows hyperconnectivity with sensory processing regions and reduced connectivity with prefrontal regulatory regions. So the sensory input is amplified, and the regulatory counterweight is diminished. This is why treatment has to be tailored to the condition. You can't just throw the same intervention at irritability, regardless of origin, and expect it to work.
Alright, so walk me through the actual treatment landscape. What works, what doesn't, and where are the surprises?
Let me start with the pharmacological side, where the clearest evidence is, then we'll talk about behavioral approaches. For irritability and autism, the evidence base is strongest for the atypical antipsychotics, risperidone and aripiprazole. These are FDA-approved specifically for irritability associated with autistic disorder. The landmark trial for risperidone was the RUPP Autism Network study published in 2002 in the New England Journal of Medicine, an 8-week double-blind placebo-controlled trial in 101 children and adolescents. The response rate was 69% for risperidone versus 12% for placebo. That's a massive effect size.
69 versus 12 is not subtle.
It's one of the largest effect sizes in psychiatric pharmacology. Aripiprazole had similar results in its pivotal trials. But these medications come with significant metabolic side effects. Weight gain, increased prolactin, risk of metabolic syndrome. So there's been a real push to find alternatives. A 2023 meta-analysis in the Journal of the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry looked at N-acetylcysteine as a potential treatment, and the results were modest but promising, better than placebo, not as strong as the antipsychotics, but with a much cleaner side effect profile.
What about for ADHD-related irritability?
This is where it gets interesting. The first-line treatment for ADHD is stimulants, methylphenidate, amphetamine preparations. And one of the less appreciated benefits of stimulant treatment is that it often improves emotional dysregulation, including irritability. A 2022 systematic review found that stimulants have a moderate effect size on emotional symptoms in ADHD, not just on attention and hyperactivity. The mechanism is thought to be improved prefrontal regulation. The stimulants enhance dopamine and norepinephrine signaling in the prefrontal cortex, which strengthens top-down control over emotional responses.
The same medication that helps with focus also helps with the emotional breaks.
When stimulants alone aren't sufficient, clinicians often add guanfacine or clonidine, alpha-2 adrenergic agonists originally developed as blood pressure medications. They enhance prefrontal cortical function by modulating norepinephrine signaling. Guanfacine in particular has good evidence for reducing irritability and emotional reactivity in ADHD.
For depression-related irritability?
The treatment follows the depression treatment algorithm. SSRIs are first line, and when they work for the depression, the irritability usually lifts along with it. But there's an important nuance. Some patients, particularly those with bipolar vulnerability, can experience SSRI-induced activation that actually worsens irritability. If the irritability is part of a bipolar depression rather than unipolar depression, antidepressants can destabilize mood and increase agitation. A 2021 study in the Journal of Clinical Psychiatry found that about 15% of patients initially diagnosed with unipolar depression actually had bipolar spectrum illness, and many had been made worse by antidepressant monotherapy. Irritability was one of the key red flags.
Okay, so we've got antipsychotics for autism-related irritability, stimulants and alpha-2 agonists for ADHD-related irritability, and antidepressants, with caution, for depression-related irritability. What about the non-pharmacological side?
This is where the mechanism understanding really informs the treatment design. For autism, a lot of the behavioral approaches focus on antecedent management, identifying and reducing triggers before the irritability escalates. Sensory modifications, predictable routines, communication supports for individuals who are minimally verbal. There's also cognitive behavioral therapy adapted for autism, which teaches emotion recognition and regulation skills. A 2020 trial of CBT for irritability in autistic adolescents showed significant reductions on the Aberrant Behavior Checklist irritability subscale, with effects maintained at 6-month follow-up. For ADHD, the behavioral approaches often focus on building the executive function skills that support emotional regulation. Parent training programs for children, organizational skills training, and CBT adapted for ADHD in adults. The CBT for ADHD tends to emphasize what therapists call situational analysis, breaking down frustrating situations after the fact to identify the point where a different response could have been chosen. It's essentially training the prefrontal cortex to recognize the pattern earlier next time.
You're building the brakes through practice.
There's neural imaging evidence that CBT produces measurable changes in prefrontal amygdala connectivity. A 2017 study from Stefan Hoffman's group found that CBT for anxiety increased functional connectivity between the prefrontal cortex and the amygdala, essentially strengthening the regulatory pathway. For depression-related irritability, behavioral activation is one of the most effective non-pharmacological approaches. The idea is that irritability in depression is partly maintained by withdrawal. You feel irritable, so you avoid people and activities, which reduces positive reinforcement, which deepens the depression, which makes you more irritable. Behavioral activation breaks that cycle by scheduling rewarding activities regardless of mood. A 2016 analysis in The Lancet found that behavioral activation was non-inferior to CBT for depression.
Let me ask about something that doesn't get talked about much. There's a huge self-medication piece to irritability. People who feel constantly on edge often discover that alcohol, cannabis, or nicotine takes the edge off. How much of substance use in these populations is really undiagnosed irritability driving the behavior?
This is a massively underappreciated point. The self-medication hypothesis, originally proposed by Edward Conscient in the 1980s, suggests that people gravitate towards substances that address their specific dysphoric states. For someone with chronic irritability, alcohol is a potent short-term solution because it enhances GABAergic inhibition and dampens the salience network. Cannabis can reduce sensory hypersensitivity. Nicotine improves attention and can have a calming effect.
When you see an autistic adult who uses cannabis heavily, or an ADHD adult who chain smokes, it might not be recreational. It might be untitrated self-medication.
The data supports this. A 2022 study in the Journal of Autism and Developmental Disorders found that autistic adults were about 3 times more likely to report using cannabis for symptom management than for recreational purposes. In ADHD, smoking rates are roughly double the general population, and many patients report that smoking helps them feel less irritable and more focused. The problem, of course, is that these are blunt instruments with their own harms: addiction, health consequences, withdrawal effects that worsen the very symptoms they were treating. Which is why proper diagnosis and targeted treatment matter so much. If you treat the underlying condition effectively, the drive to self-medicate often diminishes.
Let's go deeper on a mechanism question. The phrase nerves at me. I want to understand what's happening at the neurotransmitter level when someone feels that jangly, on-edge sensation.
There are several systems involved, but the one that maps most directly to the subjective experience is the norepinephrine system. Norepinephrine is produced in the locus coeruleus, a tiny nucleus in the brainstem, and it projects diffusely throughout the brain. It's essentially the brain's arousal modulator. When norepinephrine tone is elevated, your sensory systems become more responsive. Your pupils dilate, your startle response is enhanced, your attention is drawn to novel or threatening stimuli.
Nerves at me is literally elevated norepinephrine signaling.
It's a big piece of it, but there's also the glutamate, GABA balance. Glutamate is the brain's primary excitatory neurotransmitter. GABA is the primary inhibitory one. When the ratio tilts toward excess glutamate or insufficient GABA, you get a state of neural hyperexcitability. This is why medications that enhance GABA signaling, benzodiazepines, alcohol, certain anticonvulsants, can provide rapid relief from irritability. They're essentially turning down the gain.
Which also explains why benzodiazepine withdrawal causes such profound irritability. The brain has downregulated its own GABA receptors in response to the drug, and when you remove the drug, you're left with unopposed glutamate excitation.
That's exactly the mechanism. And it's a brutal clinical problem, because benzodiazepines work so well for acute irritability that patients love them, but long-term use leads to tolerance, dependence, and eventual worsening of the underlying symptoms. A 2023 study in JAMA Psychiatry found that about 12% of benzodiazepine prescriptions in the United States were for irritability or related symptoms, despite no evidence for long-term efficacy and clear evidence of harm.
What about the serotonin piece? We talked about SSRIs for depression-related irritability, but serotonin's role seems more complex than just more serotonin equals less irritable.
It is more complex. Serotonin is involved in impulse control and the modulation of aggressive responses. Low levels of the serotonin metabolite, 5-HIAA, in cerebrospinal fluid are associated with impulsive aggression, but serotonin also modulates sensory processing. Some of the sensory hypersensitivity in autism may be related to serotonin dysfunction. And SSRIs can actually increase irritability in some people, especially during the initial weeks of treatment, because serotonin has complex effects on different receptor subtypes. The 5-HT1A receptor tends to have anxiolytic effects. The 5-HT2A receptor can have the opposite effect. Activation can increase anxiety and agitation. SSRIs increase serotonin across all receptor subtypes, so the net effect depends on the individual's receptor distribution and sensitivity.
Which is why some people feel worse before they feel better on SSRIs, and some never feel better and need a different approach entirely.
Corn, let me pivot to something practical. If someone listening recognizes themselves in the description of chronic irritability, they're the person who's always on edge, who snaps at their family, who feels like their nerves are constantly at them. What's the actual pathway to getting help? The most practical starting point is a good psychiatric evaluation, not a 15-minute medication check with a primary care doctor, a proper diagnostic assessment. The differential diagnosis matters enormously here. Is this ADHD? An anxiety disorder? A sleep disorder? Sleep deprivation is one of the most powerful drivers of irritability, and it's often overlooked.
Sleep is the free intervention nobody wants to take seriously.
It's remarkable how many cases of apparently treatment-resistant irritability resolve when you fix the sleep. But assuming sleep is adequate, the evaluation should include a developmental history. Because ADHD and autism are neurodevelopmental conditions, the symptoms have to be present from childhood. If someone developed chronic irritability for the first time at age 35, that points more toward a mood disorder or a medical cause.
Medical cause. What kinds of things can produce irritability as a symptom?
Thyroid dysfunction is a big one. Hyperthyroidism can present with irritability, anxiety, and emotional lability. Hypothyroidism can cause depression with irritable features. Autoimmune conditions. There's a whole literature on neuropsychiatric lupus and irritability. Traumatic brain injury, especially to frontal regions. Even iron deficiency can increase irritability, particularly in children and in women of childbearing age. So the workup isn't just tell me about your feelings. There should be labs, a medical history, a sleep assessment.
Once the diagnosis is clarified, the treatment should follow the evidence base for that specific condition, not a one-size-fits-all approach.
This is where the mental health system often falls down. There's a tendency to treat the surface symptom rather than doing the diagnostic work to identify the underlying driver. It leads to polypharmacy. Someone ends up on an antipsychotic, an antidepressant, and a mood stabilizer, and nobody's quite sure what they're treating. Meanwhile, the undiagnosed ADHD or autism is still driving the symptoms.
Let's talk about a specific scenario. An autistic adult who's chronically irritable. They've tried risperidone and couldn't tolerate the weight gain. What's the next step?
Depends on what's driving the irritability. If it's primarily sensory, you focus on sensory modifications, noise-canceling headphones, modified lighting, reduced demands during periods of high sensory load. If it's related to transitions and unpredictability, you work on structured routines and advanced preparation for changes. If there's a co-occurring anxiety disorder, you might try an SSRI, but starting at a very low dose, because autistic individuals often have atypical responses to medications. And if the irritability is driven by intolerance of uncertainty, CBT adapted for autism has the strongest evidence. A 2019 trial from the Mind Institute at UC Davis showed that a 16-week CBT program for autistic adults reduced irritability and improved quality of life, with effects maintained at 3-month follow-up.
What about the ADHD adult who's irritable despite being on stimulants?
Several things to check. First, is the stimulant dose optimal? Sometimes irritability is a sign of overmedication. The dose is too high and producing emotional blunting and rebound irritability as it wears off. Sometimes it's under medication. The dose isn't high enough to provide adequate prefrontal regulation. The timing matters too. If irritability peaks in the late afternoon when the medication is wearing off, a small booster dose or switching to a longer-acting formulation can help. If the stimulant is optimized and irritability persists, the next step is often adding guanfacine or clonidine. Guanfacine extended release is FDA approved for ADHD in children and adolescents, and it's used off-label in adults. It specifically enhances prefrontal cortical function and can reduce emotional reactivity.
I want to circle back to something you mentioned earlier, the sensory piece in autism. You said the salience network shows hyperconnectivity with sensory regions. Is that something that can be measured in an individual, or is it purely a research finding?
Currently, it's a research finding. Functional connectivity MRI isn't used clinically for individual diagnosis. There's too much variability, and the field hasn't established reliable individual-level biomarkers. But the research is moving in that direction. There are groups working on machine learning classifiers that can identify autism based on functional connectivity patterns with accuracy rates in the 80 to 85% range. We're not at the point of clinical deployment yet, but it's coming.
In 5 or 10 years, we might see a world where someone comes in complaining of irritability, gets a functional MRI, and the scan tells you whether the driver is sensory hyperconnectivity, prefrontal hyperconnectivity, or a mood-related pattern.
That's the vision, and it would be transformative, because right now the differential diagnosis is entirely clinical. It depends on the skill of the clinician, the quality of the history, and the patient's ability to articulate their experience. Many people with alexithymia, difficulty identifying and describing emotions, can't tell you, I'm irritable because I'm sensory overloaded. They just know they feel terrible and everything is making it worse.
Alexithymia is more common in autism, isn't it?
Much more common. Prevalence estimates range from 40 to 65% in autistic populations, compared to about 10% in the general population. And alexithymia itself is associated with higher irritability, probably because the inability to identify and label emotions makes it harder to regulate them. There's a concept called emotional granularity, the ability to make fine-grained distinctions between emotional states. People with high emotional granularity can distinguish between irritation, frustration, anger, annoyance, and that precision helps them choose appropriate regulation strategies. A 2015 study by Lisa Feldman Barrett's group found that higher emotional granularity was associated with better emotion regulation and less reliance on maladaptive strategies like aggression or substance use. The implication is that teaching people to better identify and label their emotional states can actually reduce irritability.
Which is basically what a lot of the CBT and DBT emotion regulation skills are doing, building emotional vocabulary and discrimination.
DBT, dialectical behavior therapy, is particularly interesting for irritability, even though it was originally developed for borderline personality disorder. DBT has a whole module on emotion regulation that teaches exactly these skills. A 2022 study found that DBT skills training reduced irritability and emotional reactivity in a transdiagnostic sample. It didn't matter what the primary diagnosis was, the skills helped across the board.
There might be a case for DBT as a kind of universal irritability intervention, regardless of the underlying condition.
I think there is, with the caveat that it needs to be adapted for different populations. The standard DBT protocol assumes a certain level of verbal ability and insight that may not be present in some autistic individuals or in younger children. But the core skills, mindfulness, distress tolerance, emotion regulation, interpersonal effectiveness, those are broadly applicable.
Let's talk about the interpersonal piece for a moment. Chronic irritability doesn't just affect the person experiencing it. It affects everyone around them. Partners, children, coworkers. What's the state of the evidence on family-based interventions?
This is a really important angle. Irritability is socially costly in a way that internalizing symptoms like sadness or anxiety are not. When someone is depressed and withdrawn, the people around them may be concerned, but they're not directly targeted. When someone is irritable, they lash out, and the people closest to them bear the brunt of it. The research on expressed emotion is relevant here. High expressed emotion in families. Criticism, hostility, emotional over-involvement predicts relapse and worse outcomes. Irritability can create a vicious cycle. The person is irritable, the family becomes critical in response, the criticism increases stress, which increases irritability.
The family system can become an irritability amplifier.
Breaking that cycle often requires family-based intervention. Parent management training for children with ADHD and irritability has strong evidence. It teaches parents to respond to irritable behavior in ways that don't escalate the situation. For adults, couples therapy can address the interactional patterns that maintain the irritability. There's a 2021 trial of a couples-based intervention for irritable depression that showed significant improvements in both mood and relationship satisfaction.
I want to ask about something that might be uncomfortable. There's a cultural dimension to how irritability is perceived. In some communities, an irritable man is just being a man. It's normalized as masculine behavior. In others, irritability in women is pathologized more quickly, labeled as hormonal or hysterical. How does that play out in clinical practice?
It's a real problem. Irritability in men is often externalized and attributed to circumstances. He's stressed, he's under pressure. The same behavior in women is more likely to be attributed to internal factors. She's moody, she's emotional, she's difficult. This leads to diagnostic disparities. Men with depression are more likely to present with irritability than with sadness, and their depression is more likely to be missed because the irritable presentation doesn't match the expected depressive picture. Women with ADHD are more likely to be misdiagnosed with a mood disorder because their irritability is attributed to emotion dysregulation rather than to the underlying attention deficit.
The same symptom gets different clinical responses depending on who's displaying it and different social consequences. An irritable male executive is demanding. An irritable female executive is difficult to work with. The behavior is identical, but the social penalty is not.
That's good clinical practice to keep in mind regardless of the symptom. But with irritability, the interpersonal stakes are particularly high.
Let me bring this back to the mechanism question one more time, because I think there's a piece we haven't fully explored. Irritability often has a build-up quality. It's not usually 0 to 60 in an instant. What's happening during that build-up phase?
This is where the concept of allostatic load becomes useful. Allostasis is the active process of responding to stressors. Allostatic load is the cumulative wear and tear on the body from repeated cycles of allostasis. When someone has been dealing with chronic stressors, sensory overload, cognitive demands, sleep deprivation, social pressures, their baseline allostatic load is elevated. Each additional stressor doesn't start from zero. It starts from an already elevated baseline.
The buildup is literally the accumulation of unresolved allostatic load.
This maps to the neural endocrine system. Cortisol is a key player. Acute stress triggers cortisol release, which is adaptive in the short term. But chronic stress can lead to dysregulation of the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis. Some people develop a blunted cortisol response. Others develop an exaggerated response. Both patterns are associated with increased irritability. And it's also partly inflammatory. There's a growing literature on sickness behavior. When your immune system is activated, even at a low level, you get symptoms that look a lot like irritability, social withdrawal, hyperalgesia, heightened sensitivity to negative stimuli. Pro-inflammatory cytokines like interleukin-6 can cross the blood-brain barrier and affect mood-regulating circuits. A 2020 study in brain behavior and immunity found that higher levels of C-reactive protein were associated with higher trait irritability in a large community sample, independent of depression.
Treating irritability might sometimes mean treating inflammation, or at least addressing the lifestyle factors that drive it. Sleep, exercise, diet, stress management. These aren't just wellness platitudes. They have direct effects on the neurobiological systems that drive irritability.
Which brings us back to the treatment landscape. We've covered medications, therapy, sensory modifications, family interventions, and now lifestyle. It sounds like the effective approach is almost always multimodal. It has to be. Irritability is a final common pathway for multiple different underlying processes. Treating it effectively means identifying which processes are most relevant for a given individual and targeting them simultaneously. Medication alone rarely does the full job. Therapy alone may not be sufficient if there's an untreated neurodevelopmental condition or a medical driver. The best outcomes come from integrated treatment planning.
If I had to summarize for someone who recognizes themselves in this conversation, the person who's been told they're too sensitive, or always angry, or hard to be around, the message is that irritability is real, it has identifiable biological mechanisms, and it's treatable. But the treatment has to be targeted to the specific driver, not just a generic calm-down prescription.
The first step is taking it seriously as a symptom worth investigating, not a character flaw to be overcome through willpower. The willpower approach is worse than ineffective. It adds shame to the mix. The person feels irritable, tries to suppress it, fails, and then feels like a failure on top of being irritable. That shame increases stress, which increases irritability. It's a perfect self-defeating cycle.
The first thing is actually just recognizing that the irritability is information, not a moral failing. It's your nervous system telling you something about your current state and the demands being placed on it. That's a good place to land the clinical discussion. But before we wrap, I want to ask about something. We've talked about irritability as a symptom of various conditions. But is there a case for irritability as its own diagnostic entity? A standalone irritability disorder that isn't subsumed under depression or ADHD or autism?
This is an active debate in the field. The DSM-5 introduced Disruptive Mood Dysregulation Disorder. DMDD, specifically to capture children with severe chronic irritability who were being misdiagnosed with bipolar disorder. DMDD is essentially an irritability disorder. The core criteria are persistent irritable mood and severe temper outbursts. It was controversial when introduced, partly because some researchers argued it was pathologizing normal childhood behavior. But the longitudinal data has been fairly compelling. Kids with DMDD have different outcomes than kids with bipolar disorder or ADHD. They're at higher risk for depression and anxiety in adulthood, not for mania. And the neural imaging findings show a distinct pattern, heightened amygdala reactivity to negative emotional faces, with reduced prefrontal amygdala connectivity.
The field is moving toward recognizing irritability as a transdiagnostic dimension that can also, in extreme cases, constitute its own disorder.
That's the direction. The NIMH's research domain criteria framework includes a frustrative non-reward construct that maps directly onto irritability. The idea is to study these dimensions across diagnostic categories rather than assuming that irritability in depression is fundamentally different from irritability in ADHD, which might eventually lead to treatments that target the irritability mechanism directly rather than targeting the parent diagnosis and hoping the irritability resolves. There are already early phase trials of novel compounds, kappa opioid receptor antagonists for the dysphoria component, orexin antagonists for the arousal component. It's early stage, but the pipeline is more mechanism-focused than it was a decade ago.
Now, Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
The Aztec board game Patoli used dried beans as dice, and the painted markings on the beans were made with cochineal, a red dye derived from crushed insects that chemically bonds to calcium-based surfaces. In the early medieval period, the same dye compound, carminic acid, was being traded as far as the Outer Hebrides, where it appears in trace amounts on bone gaming pieces excavated from a Norse settlement on Lewis.
The Aztecs and the Vikings were connected by bud juice.
The global supply chain has always been weirder than we think.
This has been my Weird Prompts. Our producer is Hilbert Flumingtop. If you want more episodes, you can find us at myweirdprompts.com or on Spotify. We'll be back with another one soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.